On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, today on the bookshelf, we've got a very interesting situation to discuss. It's a book which is also now available in audiobook. The author is Dr. Philip Goodrich. The book is Somerset, or Why and How Benjamin Franklin Orchestrated the American Revolution. For more information, you can check his website, philgoodrichauthor.com. Audiobook producer and director is Mae Wuthrich. The audio version is available now, and it's got an absolutely fascinating premise. And let me first say that Phil is a history buff who stumbled onto this story while browsing a bookstore remainder table. He is a graduate of Northwestern University and the University of Southern California School of Medicine, a practicing general surgeon in suburban Kansas City, Missouri. Happily for us, fascinated, as many of us are, with American history. So, Phil, thanks so much for joining us today on the bookshelf.
Hey, thanks for accommodating me. I appreciate it.
There are several things in your book that I had never heard anywhere else or read anywhere else. The premise, of course, which is what makes the book, really particularly and unique, but also some peripheral things leading up to the revolution. One of the things was I never realized that all of the colonies were not exactly the same in their relationship to the British crown. And that surprised me, and that sets up the situation that sets up the cabal that is fashioned by Franklin, right?
Exactly. Yeah. The fact that Pennsylvania was operated by this little family group and really led by Thomas Penn, the son of William Penn, who is the founder, it created an issue where if that family group wasn't interested in providing for defense and infrastructure of the colony, they were under no obligation to do so. Franklin is frustrated at the lack of defense, and Franklin is the one founding father that survived not only the French and Indian War, but also King George's War 20 years before that. So it's a source of deep frustration and fear for him that Pennsylvania has essentially no militia and no defense.
Thomas Penn was not particularly interested in spending any money in order to do it. It kind of reminds me of what we call slumlords now, who just bought a building or, in his case, inherited a building, and they're not going to do anything to improve it. They're just going to make money off it as long as they can.
Sure, it was just shameless profiteering off of the hard work of the Pennsylvania settlers.
Franklin tries to do the right thing. He has connections in London. He goes over to talk to them about the shoddy way he feels like they're being treated in Pennsylvania, but it is remarkably unsuccessful, correct?
Yes. You know, I think he was naive in that regard. He thought, okay, if I just sit down and explain this to the people in Parliament and to representatives of the Crown, they'll understand and they'll fix this for us.
Wouldn't that have been nice?
he had no experience with anything in Great Britain. Essentially, none of the founding fathers did. It is totally nonplussed that neither Parliament nor the Crown has any intention of taking the colony of Pennsylvania away from the Penn family. It's rightfully theirs. They hold the title. They hold the charter. It's theirs, and they're paying their respects and tribute to the Crown and to Parliament. So why would they take it away from this family?
How does Franklin get involved with this group of people? Who were these people that he brought into his confidence, and why did he bring them in?
To a degree, yes, he brought them together, but they invited him. You have to keep in mind that this man was one of the premier scientists of the Western civilization at the time. His experiments in electricity and some of his work in other areas, such as the interface between oil and water and currents of the Atlantic Ocean, were novel at that time. And they were just captivated by this man and wanted him to be, you know, part of their little group. This was a group that he styled the Club of Honest Whigs. They were a Whig group in London at the time that were somewhat disloyal to the Crown and were the opposition party in Parliament at the time, and they readily welcomed him into the group for philosophical discussions. Over the course of time, he identifies a key group of about five people within this that, by virtue of their financial status or their political status, he can tell are shakers and movers in London.
Was this in some of the material that you discovered at this used bookstore? Or?
No, this has been a lot of reading over a significant period of time. I had to unearth this from about 60 different texts, both modern and older texts from the time in the 18th century. But what they were talking about was who are these people? And, you know, nobody in American history has really looked into this, has looked into the impact of, for example, the Pownall brothers. What was the impact of David Barclay, the founder of Barclays Bank? You know, these people were not living in a vacuum. They were people living in the day-to-day life in London, and they were watching this interface between the crown and the American colonies play out in real time. And there were a lot of things that were going on that they didn't like. And when Franklin said, you know, here's how we're experiencing it in America, they sympathized with him. And they said, well, Ben, here's what you can do if you don't like the situation as it is. And they became willing Confederates in the whole process.
Essentially, what they are discussing would be considered treason, right? I mean, they're talking about helping a major colony escape the grip of the crown and parliament, and these are all British subjects.
Yes, and it gets precious close to that. You know, initially it was all hypothetical, but as we get into the 1770s, it starts getting dangerously close to high treason against the crown. And at that point, they have to start being far more circumspect with what they're doing and who's aware of it, because at that point in London, there are already spy groups supported to the government and opposed to the government working almost side by side to try to sort out, you know, who's with us and who's against us.
The person who is the namesake of your book, would it be fair to say that his circumstance played into sort of an idea that they had or of setting up one part of the American colonies against England in one way and the other part of the colonies against England in from a completely different, almost diametrically opposed situation, right?
Yeah, this is clearly an inflection point in the entire story, and that's the actual side story of James Somerset, and that's why I put it in as an interlude section, because it really is significant in and of itself, mm-hmm. and it provides the entire basis for how the Somerset decision played into Franklin's design. Franklin, by that time, has been instructed by his friends in London that there's no way he can separate Pennsylvania from the British Empire. The only way he's going to be able to get Pennsylvania separated from the British Empire is if he can take the other 12 colonies along with him. So at that point, he has to identify a motivator. Now, we really don't know who came up with the initial idea for, you know, if a single enslaved person is freed by the British court system, that would motivate the southern colonies of what is now the United States to pursue separation from the empire. It may have been Franklin. It may have been one of his London friends. It may have even been David Hume in Scotland, who was kind of leading the Scottish Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. But whoever came up with it, Franklin immediately grabbed onto it and acknowledged that here's the solution. Here's what we need. We need to essentially affect the liberation of a single enslaved black African in the London court system. That will tell the southern British colonies in America that Great Britain is getting ready to abolish slavery. And with that threat, that should bring in all the colonies from Delaware to Georgia.
And yet they also spun it to the northern colonies, which were starting to trend toward abolition at this point, particularly Pennsylvania, which was by and large a Quaker denominational traditions of the Quakers, correct?
Yeah, there was a significant Quaker presence in Pennsylvania at the time, obviously. from the northern side, Franklin knew it was going to take something completely different, because although slavery was ongoing from everywhere from New Hampshire to Georgia at that time, there was already movement afoot in Massachusetts, as well as to a lesser degree in New York and Pennsylvania, leaning toward abolition. So he knew that the threat of loss of slavery, if anything, might even be embraced by the northern colonies, and that was the last thing. So he needed a different motivator entirely, and that was provided by his dear friend Thomas Pownall. That little piece of the story is undisputed at this point, and we even know that Thomas Pownall was the one that actually stole the Hutchinson letters.
And this is critical why.
Okay, the Hutchinson letters were written by the governor and lieutenant governor, the royal governor and royal lieutenant governor of Massachusetts in the 1760s. And what they said was, yes, we know the French and Indian War is over, and yes, we know you want your military brought back to Great Britain. But listen, there are these radical colonists here like John Adams and Samuel Adams that every time you hit us with another tax bill, they go crazy. And they harassed the revenue agents. They torn down my house. They torn down the lieutenant governor's house. They smashed windows. They marched through the streets. These people are half crazed. And if you don't have a military presence here, our lives could be at stake. So the British government, of course, agrees with the royal governor and the royal lieutenant governor and agrees to leave soldiers in London. And even more so, they agree that the best place to put the British soldiers is in the homes of all the patriots and make them pay for their for essentially their shelter and feeding. And at that point, they can listen in on all the patriot meetings. So this, of course, just enrages the colonists, including the Adams cousins, that much more. Ultimately, this ends up with the Boston Massacre of 1770, where five patriots are killed in the streets outside the old state house. At that point, things kind of settle down, and Franklin needs something to jumpstart them again. And the something is leaking these letters that called for the British military to stay in Boston and in New York and in Philadelphia to provide for protection of British loyalists. And they realized that once these letters are leaked, that it was the royal governor of Massachusetts that, in effect, caused the Boston Massacre, and it's going to happen again and again and again because they're going to leave the military there to shoot anybody that protests.
Right. And all along they had said the reason that the soldiers were there were to protect the citizenry from the indigenous people, from the various Indian tribes that were being stirred up by the French and had been stirred up prior to the French and Indian War.
That was their excuse, yes.
Yeah, but that obviously was not true at all. Now, it's interesting to me, too, that one of the members of this secret group, this cabal, is a former colonial administrator and essentially wrote a textbook on how to be a good colonial administrator, which was, I think it's fifth printing or something by the time all of this is going down, and that's Thomas Pownall. I'd never heard of him before, except in passing, but this gives a whole new significance to his role in organizing all of these circumstances and using them for the benefit. What these guys were doing in part really was finding ways to use information, to leak information, and to spend that information in, to benefit them in promoting the fact that the American colonies didn't need to be colonies anymore, but needed to be a separate nation.
That's correct. By this time, Franklin and his little group had become experts at propaganda. They knew when to leak it and where, and how to get things stirred up throughout the American colonies. It's regrettable that our traditional history books, as well as a lot of our modern historians, have totally neglected the story of the Pownall brothers. Because by the time of the American Revolution, to a degree, the Pownall brothers were pretty much running foreign policy in London. And yet they were both personal friends of Benjamin Franklin.
In case you're just joining us, you've missed out on some very interesting conversation already, but we're talking to Dr. Phil Goodrich, who is the author of Somerset, or why and how Benjamin Franklin orchestrated the American Revolution. Check his website, feelgoodrichauthor.com. Also available, and which is the latest addition to the book, is an audio book that is available now as well. The unabridged audiobook is almost 14 hours long, so it contains all of the information that's in the book, for sure. Although the book is also available on the website, as well as the Albany Plan of Union. Is that what their private title for how do we get the colonies to become united and separate from the mother country?
Well, that's certainly how Pownall and Franklin first met. You know, that dates back to 1754, and that was a Congress that was called together actually by the Crown and Parliament in London. They had directed as foreign policy some representatives from the colonies themselves, as well as representatives from the British government, to sit down and figure out how to defend all the British colonies, as you indicated, against incursions by either the French, the Spanish, or the indigenous people. And Franklin goes to this meeting in Albany, New York, with his own little paper that he has styled the Albany Plan of Union. Ironically, Thomas Pownall had done the same thing as Lieutenant Governor of New Jersey at the time, and they hit it off, obviously, quite well, because they became friends for the rest of their lives. And during the time of the Congress, they sit down and they kind of iron out the differences, and they present a united plan called the Albany Plan of Union that is presented both to London as well as to the American colonies.
The significance of the slavery system in place in Great Britain at this point is enormous, isn't it? It isn't that there were a lot of slaves being held or people being enslaved inside England and Scotland, say. They did have the Irish to kick around, so they didn't really need
Africans. And the Scots,
Africans,
to a degree.
Yes, and the Scots, too. So they didn't really need African slaves in England, but they used them in their colonies in the United States, or what would become the United States, in the Caribbean colonies and so forth. And they made an enormous amount of money off of the human trafficking, right?
Yes, this is the very beginnings of the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain. And as you indicate, they are doing this on the backs of enslaved persons of many stripes, including not only the chattel slaves of African origin, but also the indentured servants of Europe, as well as even the apprentices, because none of this is paid labor. They, as you indicate, they are making a fortune off of this, and this is the beginnings of the industrial development of Great Britain, and really powers them ahead of the rest of Europe to the point where they are now the most powerful empire in the world by the end of the 18th century.
When did Thomas Paine really come on the radar to Benjamin Franklin? This was interesting, because we usually think of them as sort of, or at least the traditional history books generally make it seem as though they only met each other after Paine becomes a popular and rousing writer during the Revolution. But,
yes, and I was totally unaware of this story. This was fascinating, because Franklin essentially rescues Thomas Paine from being on the brink of debtor's prison. Thomas Paine was a nobody. Thomas Paine was a revenue agent in Great Britain. He had only a modest education. He was a failed staymaker, regardless of whether you consider that a corset sewer or a rigger of ships is immaterial. He essentially had failed at business. He had failed at being a revenue agent, and he was broke. And if you were broke in Great Britain, you were headed for debtor's prison if you couldn't come up with a way to support yourself. So Franklin finds him in a tavern in London and offers him a job. And the two of them get together in the summer of 1774, and under Franklin's tutelage, as well as that of Pownall and Barclay and probably several other figures in politics at the time, he becomes the greatest political writer of the 18th century, almost out of whole cloth. So the only thing we've got left from this is we know that Franklin paid for Thomas Paine's passage. We know he wrote him a letter of recommendation to his son-in-law to find him a job as soon as he got there and to kind of look after him. And we know he came with a sheaf of papers to publish in the Philadelphia Press.
I do want to return to James Somerset, who is kind of the central figure that sets up this incredible story. He was enslaved, but he was given a great amount of responsibility because he was smart and because he learned and he understood how to get by in the world in which he was forced to live. But when he gets to England, he's relatively happy as an enslaved person could be, until he meets free blacks and they say, you might be dressed well and all of that, but you're not free.
Exactly. And I think that's when the reality of what being an enslaved person finally hits James Somerset, and that's when he runs away. Unfortunately for James Somerset, he was far times better dressed than any of the free blacks of London at the time, who essentially were living under the streets as extremely impoverished people. And so it's relatively easy for the bounty hunters who are all over the docks of London to find him. And within 6 weeks, they find him, take him to his purported owner, the slave owner, Charles Stewart, to bring him back for a reward. And Charles Stewart is so enraged that he says, I don't want him back. Put him on a ship and send him to Jamaica and auction him off there. And that's when the abolitionists step in and they go, whoa, 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 whoa. When they file for a writ of habeas corpus with the London courts and have him freed to on their bond for a court hearing. So that's when the wheels start rolling as far as Somerset appearing in the British courts in consideration of whether this man can be shipped to Jamaica as an enslaved person or whether his mere presence in London means that Charles Stewart no longer has any say in terms of his life.
One of the ironic twists of this case is that because of the fact that Stewart was so frustrated and angry that he never reclaimed him, for all intents and purposes, that meant that these guys, instead of being slave retrievers, became kidnappers of someone who at that point became apparently a free man.
And that is Lord Mansfield's read. Lord Mansfield is the Chief Justice. You know, Charles Stewart and your bounty hunters have taken away the potential solution of just giving this man back to Charles Stewart, because Charles Stewart has already stipulated that he doesn't want him. So at that point, what is his status? And as far as Lord Mansfield, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in London, is concerned, that automatically makes him a free man. He said, I don't have any other remedy. The only remedy is the black must be free. The people of London, by all indications, just go wild over this. There's just pandemonium around the British court system when this is released, that, oh my goodness, they have actually freed an enslaved African person. And that's when this whole story starts unspooling very quickly. This is when Franklin immediately alerts the plantation owners, slave owners, slave traders in America and tells them, London's going to free all your slaves. They're going to arm them. They're going to send them back to kill you and to take all your women and children. Said, if you stay in the British Empire, your lives are over.
And then he tells the Quakers, hey, guess what? They're fighting over this, and they might have freed one, but they're not going to free them all. So we've got to band together and get them all free. playing both ends against the middle.
And he does that very badly. It's a terrible story. It's Franklin the radical and Franklin the revolutionary, and who knew?
Kindly old Ben Franklin. Those are the ones you got to watch, aren't they? The ones that everybody thinks are harmless, they're the ones that are plotting all along. And of course, during the Revolution, when the British came upon enslaved people, they often offered them the chance to fight for them in the British Army. And if they were in the British Army, then they became de facto free. And they used that against the colonies, particularly against the southern colonies.
Correct.
So it became
not only in the Revolution, but also in the War of 1812, same policy.
This is really an absolutely amazing story, and it warms my heart, I must say, Phil, that this was discovered and written not by someone who has 14 degrees in history and has been reading on Benjamin Franklin his entire life and therefore knows everything there is to know about the 7 years that Benjamin Franklin was trying to get Thomas Penn divorced from his colony and all that sort of thing, but someone who just loves history and found this incredible story and chased it and chased it and chased it down and put it all together. To me, that's what makes history great. It isn't because doesn't just belong to the handful of academics. It belongs to us all. And there are incredible stories that are out there because history is the story of people.
Yeah, I appreciate your kind words very much. Thank you. It's very humbling. I think this is a story that America simply needs to know. It's done in a very non-judgmental fashion, but it's just hard facts with a voluminous amount of citation support.
Oh, yeah.
That this is here, and this is what happened, and this is how this played out. And we simply, as United States people, need to be aware of that this is part of our history.
It's an amazing story. Phil, thank you very much for all the work that you did to put this book together, and thank you for making time to talk to me today on the bookshelf.
Well, I appreciate your time and your sharing the audience, and I will tell them that they are into print. There is a new and updated print version coming out during February of this year, so they can watch for that launch either on my website or wherever they normally get print books.
Excellent. During American History Month and Black History Month. So it's
correct.
That's a double opportunity. That's wonderful. Once again, they can go to your website, philgoodrichauthor.com, correct?
Correct.
Phil, thank you again. If you write another book, just keep my number, okay? Because we'll do this again.
I'd be honored.
And of course, thanks to the incredible work by William Wilberforce and his allies, the slave trade was eventually stopped in the British Empire, and slavery was abolished. And the British government began very aggressively seeking after slaving ships to stop them in the high seas. And the abolition of slavery in the United States would not be accomplished by the American Revolution or the Constitution, but until after our own Civil War. Once again, the website is philgoodrichauthor.com, the name of the book, Somerset, or Why and How Benjamin Franklin Orchestrated the American Revolution. And you can also order the audiobook produced by Mae Wuthrich, who is an award-winning audiobook producer and director with a passion for social justice issues. And that is also available from the website. So thank you so much for joining us today for American History Month and Black History Month that we're celebrating with the incredible story from Somerset. Until next week, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening on the radio and my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, God bless.